Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. We are covering, we're in the midst, we just kicked it off in our previous episode. We are kicking off the ratification debates. We covered, what was it, Delaware, and then we covered Georgia. We just started talking about Massachusetts. And as a matter of fact, I believe my last citation was a citation by Mr. King. And I want you to know that that was Rufus King. I didn't think it was, because Rufus King was a delegate at the convention. But apparently, you know, their paradigms were different than ours. And I want to point out, you know, the uniqueness of the paradigm that I think he misses. I think at this point, and this, the paradigm of the framers, they looked at democracy and republicanism in a lot different perspective as the way we have been indoctrinated in thinking that we the people meant literally a democracy. That was not the intent. And so it may not have been a key issue. It's just kind of like the militia. It was understood the militia was the integral part of the inland defense. It was the go-to force in the, within the states, within the local communities, to suppress insurrections, to stop invasions, to enforce the laws when necessary. When the local sheriff did not have the necessary power to do so. Now, you got to remember that as states started to grow, one of the things that was very integral in marginalizing the militia was, you know, they just had sheriffs. They didn't have, you know, hey, we had already won the war. Why do we need militias? So they weren't vigilant in creating the network of enforcement and protection. And the federal government was deliberate because of the big statists. They knew that the militia was their enemy because they actually wanted to pervert the Constitution to get them into a position where they started enforcing their own laws, which was the antithesis of the separations of and checks and balances, separations of powers and so forth. So anyway, I just wanted to, you know, make note of that. And I also mentioned that Eldridge Gerry, was during the fourth debate, Eldridge Gerry was asked to come. And he was basically declined not to be there. And then he was requested to take a seat in the convention, to the ratification convention, to answer questions of fact from time to time that the convention may ask respecting the passing of the Constitution. Gerry agreed to the invitation the very next day, but Gerry never makes it to the floor of the convention, and after January 19th, he disappears from view. So, in other words, he was he made it really hard for himself to be seen as a man of the integrity and character that he claimed to be, but he was very active, and again, gerrymandering was one of those things that, you know, I'm not trying to judge the man. I'm just trying to point out the historical facts that here was a guy that, you know, was a part of a great thing. And the paradigm in Massachusetts was one of very accepting of this enumerated constitution. And they, you know, they were integral. And as a matter of fact, Massachusetts was the first state to consider making amendments to the Constitution as a part of the ratification. So they forwarded a list of recommended amendments, and they were the ones that actually were the first to request for a religious test. And after the ratification was all done and the new government had formed, and Madison had asked for all the states to submit their requests for amendments, it was uniform. I mean, unanimous. Every state wanted to have religious tests, and yet that amendment was never included. Because Madison was in charge, he wanted to make sure that the federal government did not have the power to allow religious test. And if you understand the magnitude of this, when you look at senators being grilled by the godless senators like Feinswine and the rest of them, and you see how they put religious tests on these people, how can you separate your religion? They're not supposed to have any religious questions or any religious paradigms. And they do it all the time. The godless do. And we, as good, righteous people, we have to be very cognizant of that. And we have to call them out because we're not supposed to have religious tests. And the godless people are getting away with applying religious tests. That's because we make the mistake of saying that we're a disciple of this religion when we're not. We are public servants of the people of this area that happen to be of this particular faith. We have to start understanding that our job is, and we claim allegiance to in our public service position, as well as citizens, to support the Constitution, not your faith, not your religion. It's really clear. We go through this all the time. But anyway, let me get back to Mr. King's comment, because Mr. King's comment, you know, bears the need of reading it one more time. We now come, sir, to the consideration of the powers with which the government shall be clothed. The introduction to the Constitution in these words, we the people, etc. The language of the Confederation is we the states, etc. This is all a style thing. What he was really trying to lay out by pointing out the differences between the Confederacy and this government is that instead of having a Continental Congress, we actually have a Congress, the sovereigns are the legislators. And they talk about this quite a bit. But anyway, the sovereigns were split in the federal government because they had the representatives of the people that were the sovereigns, and then they had representatives of the states that were sovereign. And I got into, you know, this American republicanism. I get into it a lot. But the whole thing is that this was a paradigm shift, that it wasn't just the states in the old Confederacy. This was a merge or an awakening of multiple sovereigns and dividing their responsibilities. And that's what the Constitution does. He doesn't get into that in this particular statement, but he does kind of lay the groundwork in that particular perspective. And so the next highlight that we want to get into is from Mr. Pierce. And Mr. Pierce says this: while I am up, Mr. President, I would make some observations on what has passed over, as I think it is within the orders of the House. The Honorable Mr. Sedgwick said, if I understood him right, that if he thought that this Constitution consolidated the Union of States, he should be the last man that should vote for it. But I take his meaning to be this: according to the reasoning of Mr. Ames, that it is not a consolidation of the Union, because there are three branches in the Union, and therefore, it is not a consolidation of the Union. In other words, he's basically saying there are three different parts of the federal government. You've got an executive, a judicial, and the legislative. But, sir, I think I cannot conceive of a sovereignty of power existing within a sovereign body, nor do I wish anything in this Constitution to prevent Congress being sovereign in matters belonging to their jurisdiction. Now, I wanted to highlight this one little passage, this one clause. But, sir, I think I cannot conceive of a sovereignty of power existing within the sovereign power, nor do I wish anything in this Constitution to prevent Congress from being sovereign in matters belonging to their jurisdiction. In other words, they have a scope of jurisdiction. It's not unlimited, and though that scope is the enumerated concept. He goes on and says, for I have seen the necessity of their powers in almost all the instances that have been mentioned in this convention, and also last winter in the rebellion. And he's talking, I believe he's talking about the Shea Rebellion. I thought it would be better for Congress to have stilled the people rather than the people from amongst themselves, who are more apt to be governed by temper than others, as it appeared to me, where in the disqualifying acts, as in my opinion, we then did not keep strictly to our own constitution, and I believe such a superior power ought to be in Congress. Now, one of the things he doesn't mention, and he probably is not aware of, is that really Congress would then, if Congress was to step in because of an insurrection or rebellion, they would be calling upon the militia, who were the people of the state of Massachusetts, to go in and quell this rebellion or insurrection. And so I don't think, because maybe this at this point in time, Mr. Pierce hasn't gotten, because you got to understand, Massachusetts is actually going line by line by line by line through the Constitution. And maybe at this point in time, this is halfway through, maybe they hadn't got through all the enumerated powers. I would have thought that they had gotten through this point and had understood this, but maybe they brushed over it, because as a matter of fact, I could do a quick word search and there's probably not a lot of usages of the militia. Let me see here. And that's the nice thing about doing it all in this way. There are three times that they mentioned the militia. That's it. Three times. So anyway, I would hope that everybody would understand that what we have is this concept. What he's trying to basically convey is this concept of jurisdiction. There is something that defines their jurisdiction, and that one thing that defines it is the Constitution. Their jurisdiction is limited to the enumerated powers. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
Okay, so here Mr. Pierce, you know, makes this comment about belonging to their jurisdiction. In other words, Constitution to prevent Congress being sovereign in matters belonging to their jurisdiction. So he goes on and says, but I would have it distinctly bounded that everyone may know the utmost limits of it, of their jurisdiction, and have some doubts on my mind as to those limits, which I wish to have solved. I have an objection as to the terms for which the Senate are to be in office for, as the Democratic branch of the federal government is to continue in office 2 years, and they are only check of the federal government, and they, the Senate, to continue in office 6 years. See, obviously, Mr. Pierce didn't understand. He's probably an anti-federalist, but he obviously isn't understanding this concept of the two different sovereigns, the House of Representatives of 2 years representation and 6 years of the Senate. He probably doesn't understand that the matters and responsibilities assigned to the Senate is at a different level and a different class of matters than the issues of the House. The House is about declaring war, protecting the people. Their interests are the people, the taxations and so forth. The Senate, its focus is the functions of government and making sure that it does not encumber or step within the bounds of the state. Too many people think that because we don't have the Senate, there's no more protection of the states. The states have the ability and responsibility to protect themselves, as Madison and Jefferson in 1798 point out. The problem is most people think that without the Senate, the states have lost representation. Well, they have in Congress, but they haven't over their Constitution. They are still the parties. In other words, just because they've changed and perverted the Constitution and this bicameral legislative body, just because they've done that, doesn't mean that the states aren't still the ones that have to ratify any changes to the Constitution. It doesn't mean that because if the Senate was still maintained by appointments, that they wouldn't allow encroachments. Because my point is, in 1849, the senators were appointed by the states, and they allowed an unconstitutional granting of the Department of Interior. So they had already had been perverted and subverted the Constitution without having the Senate being, you know, a part of the representation of the people. And if that makes sense, I'm just saying that there's way too much consideration that the Senate was really protecting the states. The states actually have the responsibility of protecting itself. The only issue was the Senates were supposed, if you look at their responsibilities of appointing justices, appointing the heads of states and so forth, the major offices and ambassadors, those types of things, then the Senate would be actually making sure that those people that are being appointed understand the republicanism in nature and understanding that they have interests to protect, that they want to make sure that the Republican form of government is being maintained instead of allowing things to be moved towards a democracy. And that, I believe, is where everything got perverted in reality. And so this next one is the Honorable Mr. Bowden. And this is on, Wednesday, January the 23rd. Excuse me. And let me see. Mr. Bowden makes this makes these comments. With regards to rights, the whole Constitution is a declaration of rights, which primarily and principally respect the general government intended to be formed by it. The rights of particular states or private citizens not being the object or subject of the Constitution, they are only incidentally mentioned. In regard to the former, it would require a volume to describe them as they extend to every subject of legislation, not included in the powers vested in Congress. And in regard to the latter, as all governments are founded by the relinquishment of personal rights, I hope you're getting this, that all governments are founded on the relinquishment of personal rights in a certain degree. In other words, when we create a county commissioner, when we create a county council, supervisors, commissioners, it doesn't matter. We delegate to them very specific rights to govern us. If they all of a sudden start doing things that we don't like, then we vote them out. The best way to constrain your government at local level, in the city, as well as the state, is to have constitutional constitutions. And if you understand, why is it that counties don't have constitutions? Why is it that there is no constraints and enumerated powers limited to the counties? So, just so you understand, counties should have the most latitude when it comes to governing, determining how to, how to put up stop signs, determining, traffic, determining, other things, economic and so forth. The state should have more hands off, but more control than the federal government. The federal government should be, should be tied to the external objects only. They should have no business in the domestic affairs. That's precisely how Madison canned it in his Federalist Papers, as well as in the ratification debates. Anyway, as he goes on, he says, they are only incidental mentioned in regard to the former linkage to the personal. Okay, so let me go on here. This is where I left off. By such a particularity, the government might be embarrassed and prevented from doing what the private, as well as the public in general, good of the citizens and states might require. The public good in which private is necessarily involved might be hurt by an enumeration, and the private good could suffer no injury from the deficit enumeration. In other words, if you give them too many powers, then you can easily be hurt. But you can't be hurt if there's far less enumerations or far less powers delegated, because Congress could not injure the rights of a private citizen without injuring their own, as they must in their public as well as their private character participate equally with others in the consequences of their own acts. I'm going to read this again. If you want evidence that basically says, as the terms of the contract, Congress cannot immune themselves from any type of legislation. In other words, if they had the enumerated power of creating health care, if that was constitutional, Congress could not pass a law of mandating health care and immune themselves where they did not have to participate in it, because it was defined in the terms of the contract that they could not do these things. How did this get lost? Because they don't want you to know what the ratification debates state. And so I'm going to read this again, and it says, the public good in which private is necessarily involved might be hurt by too particular an enumeration, and the private good could suffer no injury from a deficit enumeration, because Congress could only injure the rights of private citizens without injuring their own, as they must, in their public as well as their private character, participate equally with others in the consequences of their own acts. In other words, they cannot immune themselves. They have to be full participants in what they are doing in their regulations and in their government. Hope you get this. And then I just want to read this one little last sentence, and it says, and by this most important circumstance, in connection with the checks above mentioned, the several states at large and each citizen in particular will be secured as far as human wisdom can secure them against the abuse of the delegated power. You realize what he said? You realize that what he was saying here was that Congress was constrained very specifically to these enumerated powers, and they could not legislate or govern us any differently than themselves. In other words, they had to be in the same pool as how the laws would fall, so that those laws would oppress them equally. And as a matter of fact, I think the word oppression is actually used a little bit later. This is not the only limitation. I just want you to understand this. This was not the only mention of a limitation of Congress, that they could not immune themselves. There is actually another, and I think it's even better worded. But the interesting thing is, it was only mentioned in Massachusetts. I want you to understand that even if it was only listed in one state, where they had, the representatives had to, like Massachusetts, give you this case point with healthcare. if Massachusetts was the only ratification debate and it was legally binding, and so the people and the representatives in Massachusetts would have to be a part of this national healthcare system. Well, then the other states wouldn't have to, the legislators of the other states in Congress wouldn't have to be held to that because they didn't mention it. No. It doesn't work that way. The Constitution requires uniformity in the handling and the management of all states. So, in other words, the citizens, which Congress happens to be citizens of each of these states, cannot immune themselves because in the state of Massachusetts, they can't do it in any states for the purpose of uniformity. They have to lay the same burdens onto all the same states equally. The uniformity clause really kept Congress from being able to create outliers in these, and this is like the same thing with Texas, having their own supposedly terms of the Constitution and being participants in the Union. They have a different footing? No, they don't. They're not allowed by the uniformity clause for the federal government to be able to treat them with different footing. They may think they have different footing, but per the Constitution, they're treated equally just as all the other states. And that's the same thing, but we're out of time. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Okay, so the next person we're going to cite, and this is a really short citation. This is the Reverend Mr. Stillman. And this is what he said. He basically said, whatever were the limits of the district, it would depend on the session, I believe. Let me see here. Yeah, that would. Oh, actually, Mr. Strong was the one. And he says, because there's like these three pings, and I just missed Mr. Strong. So Mr. Strong, then Mr. Stillman, then Mr. Dench. And so Mr. Strong says that he wanted to understand Congress was not to exercise jurisdiction over a district of 10 miles, but one not exceeding 10 miles square. So he wanted to clarify that it wasn't just this 10 miles or at a minimum of 10 miles. Just so you understand this, that is how our representation has been perverted and twisted as well. We are supposed to be, every 30,000 citizens are supposed to have their own representation per Article 1 of the Constitution. But the way they've twisted it is this concept that, oh, well, a minimum of 30,000, but they, you know, Congress can dictate because they only have so many seats. Nowhere in the Constitution did it say Congress would be limited by how many seats it physically had. As a matter of fact, when they wrote the Constitution, the concept was about representation, not physical limitation of seats. To be very clear, this is one of the reasons why our First Right has this huge endeavor in trying to get the First Amendment that was a part of the 12 amendments of the Bill of Rights passed that it never has passed. The first, our First Right is actually trying to ratify the amendment that would force Congress to represent every 50,000 citizens instead of letting Congress determine how many people they represent. Isn't that the understanding of true republicanism, where we the people and our Constitution actually mean something instead of letting them become the oracles and the oligarchy to tell us how they're going to govern us? That's why I am a huge supporter for that amendment. And I want to see every state actually consider it. And if we ratify that this year, we would literally drain the swamp, or actually, I should say, displace the swamp. Every state legislator should get and understand this one amendment. That should be something that they can do on the side that would literally displace the swamp. But anyway, let me go on to what now Reverend Mr. Stillman said. And he says, whatever the limits of the district, it would depend on the session of the legislature of one of the states. And in this particular case, it was the legislature of two states, because Maryland and Virginia gave up a little portion to create the 10 nautical mile square that made Washington, D.C., because there was no delineation as to where the seat of government would be. It would be decided politically by the states as to where they decided to do this. The reason it was Washington, D.C. all came down to an evening dinner between Hamilton, Madison, and Jefferson. And I've talked about this before, but real quick, Hamilton wanted the Assumption Act to be passed, and his argument was the implied powers. Madison said there's no such thing as implied powers, but he left that to Congress. He knew that the states could easily stand up and stop this concept of implied powers, because there's no mention of implied powers in the Constitution. They're enumerated, they're very specific. So what could have happened, and Madison was probably thinking in the back of his mind, is even if this passes, the states could easily stand up and say, nope, sorry, that's not in our Constitution. Where do you have that word and verbiage? Show me, where is that in this Constitution? And Hamilton would have had to argue this implication and so forth. And they would say, okay, should we cut your tongue off, you forked tongue? Anyway, so bottom line, what ended up happening was Madison was no longer going to be the ardent opposition. That way, there was a big compromise that the federal government would assume the debt and create this national bank. And on the flip side, that Washington, D.C. would be created right there in between Maryland and Virginia, where Virginia land speculators like Jefferson looked with, you know, rubbing his hands, thinking, oh, I might be able to buy some land and make some money here prior to the seat of government coming. In other words, he might have been doing just like what our previous Congress or our current Congress is doing, and they actually get insider trading. They make millions. They sell before, you know, the news actually hits the streets. So they never lose a penny. They always stay ahead, and that's how they become very well-to-do and rich. That's how they become millionaires and so forth. Anyway, the next comment that came out of, I mean, literally, it was Mr. Strong, Mr. Stillman regarding the district, and then Mr. Dench throws this twist into it, and he says, I wish further light on the subject, but from the words of we the people in the first clause ordaining this Constitution. He thought it was an actual consolidation of the states. In other words, he was going back to this concept of we the people. You know, what the heck's going on here? And so even though it was a couple of days earlier when, and who was it again? It was Mr. Pierce, I believe. No, it was Mr. King. Mr. King was the one that clarified all of this. So, anywho, back down to another comment, because we want to move past Mr. Dench wanting to know more about the We the People. General Brooks of Lincoln was the next person up that actually he stood up and said, to consider the idea suggested by the gentleman last speaking that this Constitution would produce a dissolution of the state government. So let me get into what he actually just said. And this is Mr. Dench again, and he said he'd like further light on the subject. We the people in the first clause, considering this Constitution, he thought it was an actual consolidation of the states, and that if he was not mistaken, the moment it took place, a dissolution of the state governments would also take place. In other words, this was like a fear-mongering line that, you know, the states were going to be dissolved as soon as we create this United States. Trying to get people to go, oh, maybe we shouldn't ratify. Obviously, Mr. Dench was an anti-federalist, or maybe he was just seeking the truth because he had heard rumor. Either way, General Brooks of Lincoln stands up and says, to consider the idea suggested by the gentleman last speaking, that this Constitution would produce a dissolution of the states or a consolidation of the whole, which, in his opinion, he said, was ill-founded, or rather a loose idea. In the first place, says he, the Congress under this Constitution cannot be organized without repeated acts of the legislatures of the several states. And therefore, if the creating power is dissolved, the body to be created cannot exist. In other words, how can you create the Senate if the states don't exist anymore? And therefore, if creating power is dissolved, the body to be created cannot exist. In the second place, says the general, it is impossible the general government can exist unless the governments of several states are forever existing as the qualifications of the electors of the federal representatives are to be the same as those of the electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislatures. It was therefore, he said, impossible that the state governments should be annihilated by the general government. And he said strongly implied from the part of the section under the debate which gave Congress power to exercise exclusive jurisdiction over the town, that they shall have it over no other place. In other words, they should only have exclusive jurisdiction over nowhere else but that town of Washington, D.C. When we attended the Constitution, we shall see, says the general, that the powers to be given to Congress amount only to a consolidation of the strength of the Union, and the private rights are not consolidated. The general mentioned in the rights which Congress could only infringe upon, and said that the powers defined what was treason was much less than is vested in the legislature of his state by your own constitution, as it was confined in the third section of the Article Third to levying war or adhering to and conforming enemies only. He mentioned that the restraint upon Congress in the punishment of treason and compared it to the extended powers lodged in the Parliament of Great Britain on like crimes. And so he goes on and talks about each state is a republican form of government. So he kind of just, you know, glances over all of these things in supporting these things that the states are integral to the Constitution. This is where I'm just trying to give you this as a great example that we, the people, had a lot of different understandings and perplexing definitions by the anti-federalists as well as other people. In other words, it was obvious as the Constitution hit the different state legislatures, everybody read that we, the people, ambiguity for what it was, as a literally as an interpreted democracy, an interpreted consolidation of the federal government. There were lots of different ways, and that is how they have used that style change. I'm an advocate. that we go back and eliminate the style change to the Constitution and actually make the Constitution say, we the people, and then list every single state alphabetically, we the people of these states. It would then create the paradigm for you to understand that you have a sovereign body that has representation in this Constitution, which is your state body. With that, hopefully that all makes sense, and we will move on. We'll be right back.
Are you a patriotic proprietor of a business that is looking to get exposure on a fast-growing program? How would you like to get exposure on the only program on the air that provides an actual constitutional solution to all the federal government overreach and encroachments? If you understand the importance of educating the electorate, we would love to work with you in growing your business and revenues while you support the airing of our content on this station. Your support goes to growing the reach of this show and does not pay for elaborate salaries or highfalutin lifestyles. The show is growing fast, and we're also planning on airing the content about Republic Review on a video medium soon. If you'd like to be a part of history and the growth of the most relevant and result-oriented show on the air anywhere in the world, then just email me at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can lock in exceptional pricing and great advertising opportunities. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, so before I go on, I know I've talked about this before, that I am not a, you know, obviously a well-trained and polished and work my way, my chops through, you know, paying my dues, you know, in doing local and so forth and so on. Like some of these conservative entertainers on television, these big shots behind these golden microphones and so forth. I am not a slick packaged entertainer. You know, obviously when I read things, you can tell, I mean, we all make mistakes, but I'm not editing. We're not doing anything like that. What we want to do, because we want you to understand, not to take my word for what I am saying. Do not take my word that, you know, that blindly that the federal government is limited. I want you to take the framers' words. Even they made mistakes. Even they pronounced things in ways that's maybe a little hard to discern or understand what they're saying. But I'm here to tell you that the message is very clear, that we have a government that is so far outside the boundaries of the Constitution that we're at the precipice of failure. And so I kind of like the fact that I happen to be that raw provider of information, because I believe it creates a genuine perspective for you so that you understand that I'm just a guy that puts my pants on one leg at a time, just like you. And here we are dealing with a real problem. And I'm just trying to be the voice in the wilderness, not necessarily some well-groomed, articulated person. I mean, I do have good hygiene, but I'm not this well-groomed, professional, the epitome of a person behind a microphone. Fact of the matter is that we have an enumerated constitution that granted only certain powers to the federal government.
and they have made choices and decisions, even with allowance by the states, all of which have been outside the boundaries and processes of the Constitution. They have built a house of cards. It's time to blow the cards down, save this republic, bring back and preserve our liberties if we are going to preserve them. This is why it is paramount that you understand these things and you understand them from their perspective, from their words, Mr. King's words, Mr. Hancock, Mr. Adams, Mr. Madison, so forth and so on. I want you to know that what I am saying is the cold, hard facts. That's it. I'm not out trying to, you know, point my finger at any evil person. Everybody that believes the lie and wants to perpetuate the lie is the problem. Okay? And this is why I think we have to be a little bit honest and a little bit understanding that there have been a lot of people that have been bought into this over 200 years, that as we dismantle this unconstitutional house of cards, we have to have a little bit of compassion instead of just, you know, firing everybody today when we finally have the, you know, when we finally take the power. We can't do that. We can't take a scorched earth attitude. That's wrong when it happens to you. It's wrong when it happens to anybody. What we need to do is we need to give them time to make the adjustments. That's why I highly recommend, and we the people whose constitution is it anyway, that what we do is, you know, create a timeline, create a schedule so that when we start, you know, downsize, getting rid of the Department of Education, that the first person that actually loses their job is, you know, when they find out about it, they've got 6 months. That gives them a long time to, you know, go through the cycle of denial, anger, and all these other things to, you know, that they've been duped all these years. But it also gives them time to realign and figure out how and where they're going to find a job, whether that be in the state government or whether that's going to be in the private sector and become a productive member of society outside of this Leviathan unconstitutional government of the federal government. So anyway, I hope this makes sense. You know, I just want you to understand that when we got these hard, cold facts, we don't have to use the iron fist like the federal government and the intolerable progressives have been using with us. I believe that we always have to stay on the high road. We have to be understanding. We want to make sure we administer justice, but we also have to use mercy as a tool as well. And so anyway, this next one is from General Heath. He's already talked before, and this is what he says. Mr. President, after a long, painful investigation of the federal Constitution, I forgot to tell you that as I looked at it, prior to those last conversations, because people were kind of glancing ahead, you know, by Mr. Dench, you know, and Mr. Stillman and so forth, the exclusive legislative rights and all these things, they hadn't gone through paragraph by paragraph. Now, 5 days later, they've finally gone through this, and Mr. General Heath basically says this: Mr. President, after a long and painful investigation of the federal Constitution by paragraphs, this honorable convention are drawing nigh to the ultimate question, a question as momentous as ever invited the attention of man. What a profound statement. That there has never been a body of men ever that has basically dealt with such a momentous question. We are soon to decide on a system of government digested not for the people of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts only, not for the present people of the United States only, but in addition to these, for all those states which may hereafter rise, because they knew this baby was going to grow. They knew this. Actually, I believe that the framers understood the United States would encompass the world. I don't believe that their concept was really beyond that. I believe that that's why they allowed other states to apply. But anyway, hereafter rise into existence with the jurisdiction of the United States, and for millions, now billions of people yet unborn, a system of government
not for a nation of slaves, but for a people as free and virtuous as any on earth. And what he meant by slaves here, he wasn't talking about the labored slaves or anything like that, but the citizens being subjugated by government. In other words, he was very clear in understanding, and so were the framers. These men knew what communism was all about. These men understood statism and Plato's Republic. They understood that this was to be a people of free and virtuous people as any on earth, not for a conquered nation subdued to our will, but for a people who have fought, who have bled, who have conquered, who under the smiles of heaven have established their own independence and sovereignty and have taken equal rank among the nations of the earth. Wow. That's such powerful words. Anyway, he goes on this and says, or he goes on and says, in short, sir, it is a system of government for ourselves and for our children, for all that is near and dear to us in life. And on the decision of the question is suspended our political prosperity or infelicity, perhaps our existence as a nation. We can now be more solemn. We can now be more interesting. Everything depends on our union. I know that some have supposed that although the union should be broken, particular states may retain their importance, but this cannot be. The strongest nerve state, even the right arm, if separated from the body, must wither if the great union be broken. Our country as a nation perishes, and if our country so perishes, it will be as impossible to save a particular state as to preserve one of the fingers of a mortified hand. Now, I don't have a lot of time, so I'm going to just basically give you a perspective of the Civil War, because what ended up happening, as I've said this before, the Southern states seceded. They actually left the Union. Abraham Lincoln refused to allow them to leave, but they did leave. Bottom line, whether you like it or not, they seceded, and all rights and stakes in the Constitution, they let go of. And so, after the Civil War, the 14th Amendment, when it was ratified by the Union without the South. Knowing the South had to come in, they mandated that the South also had to ratify the 14th Amendment. Now, there's a lot of people out there that feel like the 14th Amendment was, because of that, it was not properly ratified. But you got to concede that if the South, there are so many people that take this argument that the South themselves seceded, they left the Union, and they were then at the hands of Northern aggression. And then out of the other side of their mouth said, well, they didn't have a chance to properly ratify the 14th Amendment. You can't have your bread buttered on all sides. Either they seceded and then they weren't a part of the Union, so when the 14th Amendment was ratified, they had no stake in it. The Union ratified it, and then when they brought the South in, the South had... So what happens when a new state comes into the Union? Even if you've left, you come back in, you're coming back in under the same guises that you are accepting the Constitution and all of its amendments. The only difference, because they knew the South was going to play badly, because they were already playing badly with the freemen that they had just freed, so they knew that they had to force them to acknowledge the 14th Amendment. I would have rather that they'd gone down a different path. I would have rather that, you know, there was another way. But these men were of a different time. They had a different paradigm, but they were inspired, and they did give us everything we needed, such as Section 3. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. And we'll be back with more of the Massachusetts debates in our next episode. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobius Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobius Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.